Law and Disorder, the podcast that gets real with addiction, recovery, and everything in between. Hear the 360 degrees with your hosts, Tim,
Disorder,
and Joe,
Law,
with guest speakers specializing in every field related to why you just tuned in. Welcome to Law and Disorder. And remember, recovery is possible. Tim and Joe, it's all yours.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. I'm Tim.
And I'm Joe.
We are recording episode number 8, which is pretty amazing how quickly everything is happening.
It's going quick.
You can find out just how quickly if you follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and you're probably listening to us on Anchor, Buzzsprout, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher, perhaps. Apple Podcast is coming soon, too. So things are happening quick. We have some people in the media to thank real quick. Winter Kiefer of MLive, Nick Palazzi of the County Press, and Jamie Sherrod of WNEM have all helped us to further our message. We're doing our best to deliver a message of hope, a message that recovery is possible. So thank you to them for helping us to do that.
They did a fantastic job.
They did a great job, and it actually was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And it was really, really neat to see them, you know, the process, actually.
It's super cool because it kind of introduces us to the community, and people are seeing us like around town a little bit here and encouraging us, which is a pretty amazing feeling.
Right. And we're getting a lot of positive feedback. We recently received a voicemail.
Oh, yeah. From Southern California,
yep,
right?
Yep. And that was fantastic to hear. We really appreciate those voicemails.
So, yeah, definitely. We've got an email. I want to also take a quick second to say that as awesome as the positive feedback and encouragement is, don't hesitate to offer some constructive criticism. That's useful, too. We're new at this. We're trying to do our best. We want to bring you the most entertaining and informative podcast that we can. So by all means, just be honest with us because we're being honest with you.
Absolutely.
So we have a couple of things that we want to get into. I have some questions about the attitude of law enforcement that I've been meaning to ask you. And we've touched on them perhaps a little bit in the past, but hopefully we can delve a little more deeply into them. Obviously, we have different perspectives on this, although I know we agree on the end goal. We're trying to help people fight this epidemic. Nevertheless, we each have years and years of experience as playing different cogs in the machine, so to speak.
Absolutely. And it's going to be very interesting to hear your questions just from the two perspectives. You know, it's like you said, we do agree on the end goal. We do agree recovery is possible. But it's that in between, right, that we bring something kind of unique to the table where we're describing two different perspectives. Opposite ends of the spectrum. And I think a lot of people are kind of caught in the middle. They're right in the middle of us, right? So when we express our experiences and openly talk about the things that we do on each end of our place, we'll say that helps them kind of orientate themselves. And they can see, okay, this is what my loved one went through as they relate to you. And then as they relate to me, they're possibly saying, okay, yeah, there's things being done in the community in a positive manner to address this, because we all know you're not going to just slap handcuffs on somebody and they're going to be in recovery, right?
Right.
Okay.
Didn't work that way for me.
It usually doesn't.
So that's one thing we're learning from the feedback is definitely a unique situation. We're very lucky to have the cooperation and support that we do from the various entities in the community. Community mental health being one of them, allowing us to talk with Danielle, which we did an episode or two ago. I don't remember exactly when. The Sheriff's Department. So avoiding apathy. This is my question. Law enforcement officers will come into contact with the same individual over and over again. You would think that an overdose that brought one to the brink of death would be enough to change their ways. But it's just not the case. So powerful is addiction. So my curiosity is, how do law enforcement officers not become apathetic and desensitized only to the epidemic overall, but to the individual that they continue to come into contact with that doesn't seem to want to change or get help?
It's a good question, because you find often that an addict will get calls maybe 4 or 5 times within a month or 2 month period, where these are someone freaking out, okay, they've overdosed, and maybe that same officer, and we'll extend it to EMS, we can extend it to the hospital, but the same people are dealing with the same addict over and over and repetitively, right? So say desensitized, I'm not sure that's quite, the word we want to use. I guess they're limited on what they can do, right? So even if an officer said, I'm going to do like everything I can to help this person, they're still limited because they still have to respond to emergencies throughout the community that are a priority, right? So once they respond to an addict that has overdosed, let's say they administer Narcan, right?
Right.
And that person is transported to the hospital. It's at that point, they have to move on to the next call, right? And they can't just go up to the hospital and be like, hey, you need help. And there are isolated circumstances that allow that, but it's pretty rare.
Probably right? The exception.
Right, right. And so what you have is they're like, oh no, again, we're going to this address again.
Right. Right.
And you'll get a call over the radio and it's like, you hear the address and you know exactly who it is.
Mm-hmm. So then how do you, there's got to be a protocol, right? A standard of care, a way that an officer is expected to handle that situation, right? They don't just wing it.
Well, no. I think if you look at the big picture, they go in, they do what they have to do, right? To bring that situation under control, right? So everybody's safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously their main priority, right?
Right.
So they're responding to an addict that has overdosed. Their main priority would be at that point to get medical attention, right? As soon as possible. But also in this day and age, we're issuing the Narcan.
Right.
So once that's accomplished, okay, now we're moving on to the next call, right? So in a busy community, there may be 2-3 calls behind that one, right?
Right. And that kind of takes me to my next question, right? How do you guys make the time for every individual, every family, when there are so many calls and there are so few officers patrolling the streets? How do you really give everyone the time that they need?
Well, I think a big part of that is it depends on the officer, right? There's different, I don't want to say attitudes, but approaches to this issue. You have some that go out and they say, okay, we did our part, right? We have issued the Narcan. This person is now alive and they are in the hospital and they're getting the care they need, right?
Right. So you shuffle them to the medical community.
Right. So at that moment, we're almost relying on the hospital at that point, right? To further educate the individual on the possibilities of treatment.
Does that happen there? Are doctors and nurses counseling patients?
Well, I know they have literature in the ER room. Whether they're pushing that to the limits where they're, counselors or therapists showing up and saying, hey, you have a problem. You just basically died, right?
Right.
And you were brought back, and going over those options. I do know there's a program that's being implemented currently. I don't know how long that's going to take to be fully effective and rolling. But as of right now, I think it's to the point where most of them take off because A, there is nothing there, right? There's no drugs. There's no nothing.
Right.
Usually no support, right?
Right.
Because they don't want family members to know. And if they were just Narcan, right, they're pretty much pissed off at the world, right?
Probably in some state of withdrawal, depending on how much Narcan they were given.
Exactly. So not only have they worked so hard to get that money, and when I say worked,
hustled.
Right. We all know what that means.
Lied.
Right.
Cheat, stolen.
Exactly.
Whatever it took.
Right. So now are they relying on these same people that they lied to, they stole from, right, to come up and support them?
Quite possibly.
Right. So at that point, it's kind of like they want to just get out of there, right, so they can move on to the next fix, right?
Sure.
So as law enforcement, you're kind of battling that as well, right? Like we discussed in a prior episode, the one gentleman literally wanted out of the ambulance on the way to the hospital, and that's exactly what he did. We can't force medical treatment on anyone. If they're willing to sign the paperwork, guess what?
There were a couple of times I was in the hospital given Narcan. I don't know that I was ever. I remember one doctor told me I was breathing 3 times a minute.
That's like nothing.
That's like not breathing, right?
Yeah.
So very close to disaster there. And he wanted to give me Narcan, and I did not want him to give it to me. And between lapses of consciousness, this debate played out. He had a nurse assist him in persuading me that they would just give me a little bit. It wasn't going to throw me into a full withdrawal. I can only imagine what that must be like for them to see this guy who's
basically
about to die,
right,
and knows it and is like, nah, I'm good. I'm just going to lay here for a while.
And can ride you
give
the
me the remote
up
to the TV?
Yeah.
Like, I was doing that. I think I was watching whatever was on CNN or something like that. Just fading in and out of consciousness, resisting the Narcan.
That's insane. Like,
it is insane.
For a normal person, they would look at him like, give me the Narcan, right?
Right.
I want to live.
Right. Yeah. I want to live. Right. It's not what was going through my mind. I want to be high.
Right.
I do not want to get sick.
I want to live long enough to switch to Fox, right?
Right. Right. So then, do you have any ideas how to like handle this? Is there an efficient way that you see in your mind? I know you said there's like a program being implemented in the hospital that had to do with, I think, literature, giving them information on the spot.
Well, I think right now the program that's being implemented will be actual therapists going or peer support or something of that sort.
Then and there.
Right. Going right to there when and saying, hey, okay, we have these services that we'd like to offer. And at that point, you know, you can't force that on somebody.
No.
It's almost like a religion. Like, if you're Jewish and I'm Catholic, you can't force it on me, right? That's not going to happen.
Correct.
So, if I don't want help, guess what? I don't want to talk to you. Give me the remote. And that's what we deal with. And I know the hospital's in a bad situation as well, because at some point when they push that issue a little too far, then you're going to have someone in dire need of medical care signing the waiver to leave. Because they feel pressured, you know, they're in a bad spot. They just lost their high, and now they have to go redo all that again.
Right.
And they're pissed off.
I think there's only two, in reality, two choices for that person in that moment. Either they're going to leave the hospital against medical advice and go do whatever it takes once again to use, or they're going to go to rehab right then and there. And if that's not offered to them, the promise of counseling in a couple of weeks or notification of where to find a 12-step meeting in the morning is not going to come into play.
It's not even realistic.
Not at all.
Right, because we all know if you're not through that detox period, right, there's a problem. You're battling another problem. It's a wall. And I don't believe that in the ER room directly after someone being Narcan'd, right, that you've made it past that point where you can actually think logically and be like, yeah, I do have a problem. I think more or less you're more pissed off and you would know. I mean, let's hear about your experience after receiving the Narcan. Like when you snapped to it, what was your first memory that you actually remember?
It's kind of overwhelming. It's frustrating. It's humbling. It's a little bit scary. It depends, I think, whether you're there by yourself or which I have been before. I've also had my father sitting next to me. I've had my mother sitting next to me at different times.
And they must have been terrified.
I wonder, they didn't express anger, but I would think they would just be angry. Just like, what the, you know?
Why is he doing this?
Again, we went through this 3 weeks ago.
Right.
It's definitely scary when, and this really only started happening at the rate it is now a few years ago when fentanyl kind of exploded into the scene, right?
Right.
5 years ago, you would buy heroin and morphine. And overdoses happened, but not as frequently as they do now. So I really began to appreciate the fact that I was tempting fate. That it wasn't any longer something I could pretend probably wouldn't happen, right? I knew that if I kept using, it would happen because the evidence was mounting. I couldn't lie to myself about the multiple hospitalizations in such a short period of time. I knew it was looming. I knew eventually I would use and nobody would be around to save me.
Right. Or the Narcan wouldn't work after the third, fourth, fifth application.
Yeah.
Right?
They're saying like they're hitting them with like four of them now to revive them.
And it's that fentanyl and carfentanyl.
I think the only, I don't know. I don't to my knowledge, there's no way to just take an addict from the ER to rehab, right? I think that's the bridge that needs to be formed. I think if you really want to save lives, just like you can be admitted immediately into McLaren's ER, Hurley's ER, you should be able to be admitted into Sacred Heart's inpatient rehabilitation. I don't know how you finagle that. I don't know all the logistics and the Medicaid and having enough beds for everybody. But I think unless they're given that immediate choice of getting help right now.
Like literally.
Literally right then.
Right. So that brings me to a point with the detox period, right? So in your opinion, do you believe that the hospitals should be somewhat equipped to put someone through the detox process? Medically supervised?
Yeah, I think that would be great if there was a transition there where, okay, maybe we can't get you into Sacred Heart tonight, but we also don't have to just stick you with Narcan and leave you there to sweat it out and put you back on the streets. Like maybe if there was some sort of detox unit, and maybe some hospitals have them, I guess it's...
Well, I'm sure if it's medically necessary, they're going to, you know, keep them and walk them through that.
There are times, though, where I assume there's some interpretation. Yes. That medically necessary, right?
Right.
And that may be dictated by how busy the ER is. There may be a lot of details that go into that that don't necessarily have much to do with how much the addict needs to be kept there.
So they really technically, after being administered Narcan, you go to the ER. And then I think from there, you know, obviously we don't know the logistics of everything. But ideally, you would think there would be somewhere else in the hospital they could go to get through that detox period.
This is, so we're trying to lead a conversation, right? And we don't have all the answers. We don't necessarily know what's available in an emergency situation like that. We have talked a little bit between ourselves,
right,
about exploring how accessible treatment truly is. And that's probably something in a future episode we're going to experiment with, right?
And I truly would like to do that. Like, I want to make random phone calls and seek out, like, okay, if I'm an addict and I decide right now I want help, right? I'm rock bottom, I'm ready. How long will it take to get placed where I can detox and start treatment?
Danielle, in prior episode, talked about one of the biggest barriers to help being transportation. And she was referring to a scenario where someone had come out of jail, been clean for a while, had a Vivitrol shot, and needed follow-up to maintain their recovery, counseling, future injections. That's a barrier there. But it's got to also be a barrier to, I don't think there's a bus that goes to Sacred Heart at 2 o'clock in the morning, right?
Right.
I don't Absolutely. Think there is one at 9 o'clock in the morning either.
No, I highly doubt that in a large city, like let alone our smaller city, you'd be hard pressed to find a taxi. Seriously.
So there are programs sprouting and developing. We have grants. We have more awareness. We have good things happening. We have people doing their best to collaborate. But sometimes I think we're overlooking the little obvious things.
The simple things.
Right?
Yep.
Just get this person the help they need right now. Don't look so far ahead and try to arrange housing, food assistance. All those things are great, but first, let's make sure they don't die. We're trying to fix all these problems down the line. We're not there yet, right?
That just tells me that certain pieces of the puzzle are in place where others are missing. So you have agencies willing, like Danielle specifically talked about that, where they have assistance for housing, food, et cetera, et cetera. They even feed them when they come to therapy, right, to the groups. So they're well aware of the issues there. So now how are they limited as far as transporting? Like, let's say someone is Narcan, taken to the ER, says, I want help. Okay, so they need to get from point A to point B, right, in the middle of the night, right? So community mental health is kind of out of the picture at that point.
Right.
Right. Because we all know there's budget issues with that. And how do you get them there, right? How do you make that connection? So what you just said as far as, yeah, they don't necessarily need all that assistance in line at that point. I agree. But that just tells me there's a piece of the puzzle missing. Like,
Right.
We're missing something.
I think it's great that those things are there. But I think like Law and Disorder Project number one needs to be discovering how to build that bridge between the overdose and the rehab. The fastest possible route from point A to point B. What is it? If there isn't one, let's create it. If there is one in existence, let's make sure it's better known. Because I'm not aware of it if there is.
No, and honestly, you have a lot of different programs, as you mentioned. They're doing what they can. They're doing the best they can. They want to help. But we run into this detox situation nonstop, right?
So, right.
And I've mentioned it before. Our county jail is the detox center for our county.
Right.
And that cannot be.
No.
It's
not set up to.
No. No, we don't have 24-hour medical. We don't have the resources if there is emergency. So now you have the transportation time to the hospital and whatnot. Because let's face it, that is a tough period to go through. You know, a detox.
It's the most critical.
Right.
If you can get somebody to stay clean for a week, now they got a fighting chance. Now maybe those promises of housing and food assistance, those incentives start to mean something.
Right. And we've talked about it where the brain starts to kind of be able to think logically with somewhat of a clear mind, right? Because when you're after that high and you're constantly concentrating on that high and that's all that matters, yeah, really food, housing, healthcare, all that don't matter, right? So now all of a sudden you're in, we'll call it the detox center, which is the county jail. You're forced to detox. And now you can actually think, okay, I need help, right?
If you're lucky enough to be incarcerated, and which not everybody is.
Right.
So what do we do about the ones that aren't going to jail, right? We don't just want them to go right back on the streets. The jail thing is a problem because it's not set up to handle what is being asked. That's my goal, personally, is to learn more about the programs that are presently in place, if any, to get an individual from overdose to rehab as quickly as possible. And if there isn't one, to do my part to push that issue forward.
And I agree that has to be done. And I think a lot of times what we see is certain organizations have their own programs in place and they're relying on something that may possibly not be available to fill those voids.
Right.
And I think that is the major hurdle going forward about every community, right? You can't just assume there's transportation. You cannot assume anything, right? And everybody is limited. Each organization is limited in their capabilities, right? And I know they do what they can, but at some point they are limited.
Right.
And where's the handoff, right?
But maybe we're not. So we're here to have that conversation and help discover what those gaps in care are.
Right.
And hopefully that's something we're doing right now. People know how to reach us. They can email us. They can leave us voicemail. They are, and we thank you for it.
It's really appreciated.
Thank you for listening today and taking the time to contemplate the best way to help somebody get attention immediately.
And I just want to put out there right now, if there's any of our listeners that live in a community that seems to have this whole thing wrapped up, to where it basically falls on the decision of the addict, right? So I want to hear from you. I mean, Tim and I would love to hear any success stories out there of any well-rounded, fully encompassed programs that are functional.
Or programs that are close and need to be tweaked. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
Hit us up.
Anchor, Buzzsprout, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google, Stitcher, Patreon. There's a million ways to get, there's at least a couple dozen.
Right.
Ways to get in touch with us. Please do. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm Joe.
I'm Tim. We'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Law and Disorder Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes. Please follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or visit our website at ladpodcast.com. Recovery is possible.